Welcome everyone to the Hum in the Silence. On this week's episode, we review Davy Copface's new documentary, Missing 411, The UFO Connection. And needless to say, we weren't impressed with it. However, I have always been intrigued by mysterious disappearances. Like, I eat that shit up, but remain skeptical about it at the same time. First and foremost, if you do want a skeptical take on the Missing 411 phenomenon, I want to recommend a book to you. It's called The Cold Vanish, Seeking the Missing in North America by John Billman. It centers around a guy named Randy Gray, searching for his missing son, Jacob. John accompanies him on many expeditions in Olympic National Park to find his body, and he tells the story of those who go in search of the missing and other missing persons cases. It's a really great book. This is a pull quote, or this is from the description. Quote, "It's a tricky thing to write about missing persons because the story is the absence of someone, a void. The person at the heart of the story is thinner than a smoke ring, invisible as someone else's memory. The bones you dig up are most often metaphorical. While much of the book will embrace memory and faulty memory, history, The Cold Vanish is at its core a story of now and tomorrow. Someone will vanish in the wild tomorrow. These are the people who will go looking." End quote. Let's just say that Dave didn't like how this book made him look, but I assure you it's well worth your time. Still, I wanted to talk about disappearances, which are strange for a number of reasons. Sometimes they come back, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes only part of them is found. But there are a number of cases that make me scratch my head for a number of different reasons. The first case is that of Steve Kubacki, a 23-year-old student at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. He went missing on the shores of Lake Michigan on February 20th, 1978. Steve was on a solo cross-country trip on the shores of Lake Michigan near the town of Saugatuck. His trip was planned to last a day or two, but on the 21st, snowmobilers spotted a pair of cross-country skis, poles, and a backpack abandoned on shore. A 200-yard trail of footprints led from shore to the edge of the ice, leading authorities to believe that he had fallen through the ice and died of hypothermia. Helicopter searches failed to turn up a body, and at the point where his footprints ended, the ice was still intact. Fast forward, over 14 months later, on May 5th, 1979, Steve woke up lying in a field in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, over 700 miles from where he disappeared. Some sources claim that he was naked, while others said that he was wearing clothes that didn't belong to him. He also had a backpack filled with maps that made it seem like he had been traveling across country and hitchhiking. On May the 5th, he showed up on his father's doorstep and learned just how long he'd been missing. He had no recollection of the previous 14 months. For the next case, I want to read an article by Brett Swanser for Mysterious Universe. The wilderness of our world often seems to draw people in to never return, as if they are hungry entities rather than just a collection of mountains and trees. Some of the strangest such cases have been written about by missing persons researcher and author on the subject, David Politis, in Missing 411, in his Missing 411 series of books, and these accounts can range from the slightly odd to the full-on bizarre. One very weird case that has been much discussed and speculated upon is that of a seasoned, experienced hunter who went out with a group of friends only to step off the face of the earth and leave strange clues and mysteries that have not been solved to this day. The setting for this strange case is the rather ominously named the Crazy Mountains, in the northern part of the Rocky Mountains of Montana in the United States, where in September of 2014, a 38-year-old elk hunter by the name of Aaron Joseph Hedges, was out on a hunting trip with friends Greg Leitner and Joe Depew. The trip started on September 3rd, when the group headed out from the Cottonwood Lake Trailhead, along with two horses and a mule. The men were in good spirits, looking forward to their excursion, and things were going smoothly as they headed towards a place called Campfire Lake. But they hit an obstacle when their mule got spooked and Hedges' sleeping bag was thrown over off the trail and lost. It was an unfortunate turn of events, but fortunately the group kept another hunting camp they had used the previous year and had loaded up with an emergency cache of extra supplies just in case they ever needed it. Among these supplies were extra sleeping bags and so on. September 5th, Aaron decided to make a trek up that way, towards a place called Sunlight Lake. It wasn't a particularly formidable distance for the experienced outdoorsman, and he had a walkie-talkie, cell phone, and was armed with a firearm and bow, so no one thought much of it, especially since he told his companions that he was just going to grab the supplies and would be back before nightfall. Little did they know that as he stalked off up the trail and into the trees, it would be the last time anyone saw him alive. Night came and went, with no sign of Hedges, and the next day he still did not turn up. The group tried numerous times to call him on his walkie-talkie, but there was no response. A look at the GPS for the walkie-talkie system showed that Hedges had missed the fork in the trail and that he was supposed to take to his destination, and it labeled his position as being out at the very edge of the screen. They waited around the area for several more days, hoping that he would find his way back to them, but there was no further word, and Aaron Hedges was finally reported missing on September 8th. A search was mounted, and although the effort was somewhat impeded by snow that had hit the area, the surroundings were meticulously scoured using helicopters with infrared equipment, horses, and 20 tracker dog teams, all of which turned up no sign at all of the missing hunter. It was not until the second day of the search that a clue was finally found. By a creek just east of Sunlight Lake was found a spot where someone had attempted to start a fire using a pack of cigarettes, and nearby were found the water bladder that Hedges had been carrying, the waist straps of his backpack, and his shoes sat down neatly side by side, as if they had been carefully removed and placed there. Oddly, the site was found in an area the search teams had just combed the previous day without finding a thing, and it was also considered puzzling that he would have taken his shoes off and just left them beside, considering the plummeting temperatures and snow. Also unusual was that tracker dogs passing through were unable to pick up a scent trail for the missing man, which was a bit hard to explain. This was the only trace of Hedges that would be found during the search efforts, and it was as if he had just vanished into thin air. But things would get even weirder, still a full 9 months after the disappearance. In June of 2015, a hiker by the name of Roger Beselnowicz was staying with relatives at a place called the Rain Acre Ranch. When he took a walk to the top of a nearby ridge and came across someone's outdoor gear, including a backpack containing a cell phone, an orange hunting vest, bow, clothes, a hunting license, and some scattered wrappers from granola bars. Bizarrely, at the head of the ridge was also a thermos cup, placed on a rock along with an open energy drink nearby. Beselnowicz would report that he had been sure there had to be a body somewhere, but he could find none, just those belongings eerily piled up against a tree. When it was found through the hunting and driver's license in the pack that they had belonged to Aaron Hedges, the authorities jumped all over this new lead in their cold case, but they could find no trace of any human remains. It would not be until the following summer that remains would finally be discovered about half a mile from where the gear had been found, which was a full 15 miles from where he had been seen and 6 miles from where his boots had been found, meaning that meaning he had somehow traversed that snow-swept wilderness without his boots all the way, along a route that had no major trails, making it even weirder that the area the remains were found in, within eyesight of a nearby ranch and right next to a frequently used road, which would have meant safety, but he had never managed to reach it. How could this be? He had obviously stopped to have something to drink on that ridge, from which he would have been able to clearly see the house. So why did he just stop, strip down out of his clothes, and die so close to safety? The whole case is permeated by strange details. The fork in the trail that Hedges was originally meant to take up to his destination was clearly delineated and visible, and he was equipped with a GPS system. Yet he had gone right by it. He had then managed to set up a camp that evaded a complete search of the same area, then taken his boots off in freezing weather, and somehow managed to walk 6 miles over rough terrain, off trail, through snow, which authorities see as highly unlikely, as it would have been an incredible feat for even the most hardened survivalist. Indeed, why had he taken his shoes off to begin with? Then there was the there's the fact that the dogs could not pick up the scent. And all of this is punctuated by the rest of his belongings and his body plopped out there, practically right on top of an inhabited ranch. The cause of death could also not be determined, as neither the skull nor any of the bones exhibited any sort of trauma, indicated any injury of any kind. What is going on here? There have certainly been plenty of theories, ranging from the plausible to the far out. The official explanation is that he had probably had hypothermia and disorientation, which had caused him to wander about aimlessly and display his odd behavior. He may have even intentionally avoided search party teams and that ranch in order to cover the fact that he and his friends may have been hunting in off-limits areas and poaching. Other theories are decidedly more fringe, including the pervasive idea that he somehow passed into another dimension or through a portal. One Reddit user on the Missing 411 forum called Dapper Winner explains his spin on the theory and how it matches many of the stranger details as follows. The turn in the path. Aaron left his hunting buddies to go to a cache that was a hike away. There was a visible path and a clear turn for him to ascend up to and get to the cache. What I believe happened is somewhere just before that turn, or on it, he passed over into another dimensional reality. It was getting late, and his friends tried to call him over the walkie-talkie, and they did ping his GPS. Now, at this point, somehow I think for a split minute or so, he flicked back into this reality in just enough time for the GPS to go off and then flicked back out. I'm no expert on this stuff, so forgive the terms. This is fucking ridiculous. The boots. The SAR has been called and they comb the area for him. Dogs also cannot get a scent. Now with the dogs, I believe the reason why they cannot find one is because he literally is not there. He is in some other dimensional reality overlapping our own. Further in the case, they find his boots and other items after they combed a particular area by the ridgeline. Similar things have happened in the other cases, so we came up with a theory that what if his items had somehow rematerialized back in our reality? Let's say that in the dimension he is in, whatever bad weather is happening in ours, the snow, is not happening where he is. So perhaps he has a rest and he takes his boots off to rest his feet. Somehow, those items reappear back in our reality, and he loses them. This would explain why his boots were found just set there as if someone had placed them there, because they were. The pack. Months pass, and somebody finds Aaron Hedges' backpack and drinking equipment overlooking a property with human houses and structures visible. Let's say Aaron did make his way to this place, and I think he knew where he was going, expecting to find those people's property. But here's the thing. They weren't physically there in that other reality. He made his way to that ridgeline expecting to find houses, but did not. And again, His items have somehow rematerialized back into this reality, where they were found by a neighbor. Now, this is where the speculation gets a little crazy. We theorize that what if the alternative reality he stumbled in, time flows differently. As they found his pack a year or so later, I believe. What if whatever he is, what if wherever he is, it's only felt like a day or two for him being lost, but in our reality, a year had passed. As I said, it's just speculation on our part, but I find it hard to believe a backpack containing food was sitting there perfectly for a year for someone to discover it without it being ravaged by wildlife. What happened to Aaron Hedges? Did he simply get lost and succumb to the stresses of the environment? Is this, as the authorities say, a case of hypothermia-induced psychosis? If so, then what are we to make of all the weird clues orbiting the whole thing? Or is this, as some of the stranger theories have posited, something altogether more bizarre and past our ability to grasp, to really grasp? Just about the only thing we really do know about this weird case is that Aaron Hedges disappeared without explanation. His remains reappeared just as mysteriously, and no one truly knows exactly what happened to him, except for him and the trees. So there's another Reddit perspective I want to include here from user Jimby. This is from an old thread. I have many of the same questions after watching this TV show. Why is it, which is why I came here. I grew up within an hour of the crazies in a small farming town nearby. My husband grew up even closer. I found it odd, but not impossible, that neither he nor I ever heard of this case. We don't live there anymore, but still close enough, and with family all throughout the area. Something like this would be fairly big news. My family are avid hunters, and his family are farmers. My dad even did MTNG training in the crazies. I hadn't heard about the case either, so it almost seems like it was talked about a lot in local news outlets. People still read the newspaper in hard copy form at the diner. Relatively speaking, the crazies are a smaller than average mountain range, not to downplay the possibility of becoming lost. They stand tall out of the prairie and are about 35 miles long and 15 wide. The tree cover is not as dense as other areas either. Access is pretty limited from what I hear, but people go in for fishing and hunting through private and public access points. I know mountains are vast, but so many people were looking and nothing was found. And then to find stuff in previously searched locations later makes me wonder if he was still alive while they were searching and they just kept missing each other. I want to know if he made it to the cache as well. I'm leaning towards no, as I think that would have been mentioned. However, I can't say it isn't impossible. It does seem slightly more like the trail could be missed on the way back down rather than up from looking at the terrain. Factored in with exhaustion and being later in the day, I also have to wonder if it's possible that he got a sleeping bag and used that for warmth while lost. It could be that his feet are found in one someday. I also find it weird that he took his bag, his gun, and bow to hike to a cache to get items that would increase the load. Aaron hit the trail to the cache on September 5th, so bow hunting season wasn't even open that day. It opened at dawn the next day. A bow isn't reliable for protection from animals, so again, why drag the extra weight on a tough uphill hike to get even more heavy items? The pack gun should have sufficed for the trip up and back. This plays into foul play territory. All of his belongings were with him. The shoe thing seems like common sense for someone who knows the Montana wilderness and does backcountry camping. Many people take a second pair of camp shoes or backup shoes if there is a chance of getting wet creek crossings. For the death by exposure theory, I would think he ditched the boots due to blisters or pain and put on different shoes. Hiking that far in snow, wet, he would have probably had terrible blisters. It is possible that he wandered in the dark and confused, suffered paradoxical undressing, DT hypothermia, and succumbed within view of civilization, but I doubt it. What I don't get, the friends. They waited a couple of days to report him missing. His mule lost his sleeping bag shortly after starting. Like, they would have been able to retrieve it fairly easily while low down on the trail. I looked at the Cottonwood Trail, and sunlight suggests on all trails and topo maps, and the lower elevations are relatively flat through wildflowers and a clear trail. There are a ton of picks, and even up to the top of sunlight, there would have been few areas that it couldn't have been recovered with little effort. I don't see how the sleeping bag got lost as alleged. It isn't adding up for me. I have backpacked, and this just doesn't sit well with me. Secondly, I don't know why the friends were up there in archery season without bows. They reportedly had guns only. Rifle season is in October. They sat there through a Montana snowstorm and let him be missing in low temps without getting any help? They, being from Montana, knew better. And Aaron, being from Montana, would have known to stay put if he was lost. Plus, he had a sat phone. Did it just quit working? In my opinion, I lean towards something going astray within the group, and his friends scattering things far and wide to make it harder to find him. That is the reason it took days to report him missing. They had to scatter his belongings and body. They had mules to help, and all the tracks would be covered by snow. Further, if his body was on a mule, the scent would be hard to follow. Why would Aaron Hedge's fire only be partially burnt? The cigarette package was left as an identifier. No avid Montana outdoorsman would give up on lighting a life-sustaining fire and an SOS signal, or fail at it. Even more incriminating, the friends wouldn't have wanted to let it burn to tip anyone off if they were planting evidence. I think the boots were placed above the falls to make it appear he fell in. His other items would probably have been hidden elsewhere to make it appear he wandered, confused, and died of exposure. My other thought is a hunter, likely a poacher, found his stuff where they placed it, or where Aaron left it, if there was no foul play, and planned to steal it. But once he came down with it, he sat on a rock to have a drink and look through the bag, and realized this stuff was from a missing man. Or he saw the house below and got spooked, and opted not to keep it. The access to the mountains is limited, with no roads going up, so poaching is common there, or so I've heard. Poaching in general is rather common in Montana, to be honest. Knowing small-town politics, I wouldn't be surprised if the friends had connections or family in law enforcement or local government. I'm sure they welcome the 411 idea to throw suspicions elsewhere. The story of Dennis Martin is one that haunts me every time I hear it. According to an article from the Knox News, quote, "The failure to find Dennis and the mistakes made led to sweeping changes in search and rescue operations in the Smokies and throughout National Park Service. Agencies around the world still study the case." Dennis Martin was 6 years old the day he went missing. He disappeared on a family camping trip at around 4 in the afternoon on June 14th, 1969. It was a bright blue day, perfect for camping, and Bill Martin, Dennis's father, drove his family to Cad's Cove on a little camping trip. Along on the trip was Bill's father, Clyde, and Bill's two sons, Doug, 9, and Dennis, 6. To quote the Knox News, quote, "Martin men helped settle the cove, tilling the rich bottomland soil at the start of every spring and driving cattle up the mountain to range on the tall grass in the treeless meadows like Spence Field, known as Mountain Balds. Every June, fathers and sons trekked uphill and set out salt licks to last the herds until the fall drive down the mountain to market." End quote. Dennis, or Denny, as his parents called him, was about 4 feet tall, 55 pounds, with dark brown eyes and wavy brown hair. Quote, he was about 6 months behind his age group in school, but field smart and fearless. This was his first camping trip into the woods, though the boy was an experienced hiker from back home. End quote. That Saturday morning, the day before Father's Day began, with breakfast at nearby Russell Field, where the family had camped. They would meet up with other members of the Martin family at a camping shelter at Spence Field. After meeting up, they enjoyed a good lunch, and the adults settled down to talk while Dennis, Doug, and two other boys played in the field. Dennis wore a red t-shirt and green shorts that day, with Oxford shoes. Quote, Spence Field sits about 4,800 feet above Cad's Cove and runs east and west along the Appalachian Trail on the Tennessee-North Carolina line. Tennessee to the north, Carolina to the south. A clear day yields views that span miles. Steep slopes, jagged ravines, and tangled hells of laurel and rhododendron vines, teeming with copperheads and rattlesnakes, lie below. Bears and bobcats mark their territory on trees along the trails, besides furrows dug by wild hogs scrounging for roots. Bears that summer had been unusually bold and hungry after a drought the previous year that left the ground mostly bare of acorns, the backbone of their usual diet. Just before 4:30, the boys put their heads together and whispered as the adults watched. Then they scattered. Doug and the others to the south, Dennis to the north, and west toward the Tennessee side. The grown-ups chuckled and waited. Bill Martin and the others jumped in pretend surprise when the boys burst out of the brush behind them with shrieks and laughter. After a few minutes, maybe two or three, by the father's count, no more than five, he insisted, came the question, where's Dennis? Doug and the other boys lost sight of him when he headed west. They didn't want his red shirt to give them away. That was when they all started to call for Dennis. Soon the group fanned out in the area, all calling out to him. But soon they had to call off their search, as a storm broke out, dumping 3 inches of rain in just a few hours. Trails turned to mud, and under the torrential rains and the high winds drowned out their calls for the six-year-old. A search commenced at 5 a.m. the next morning, though it was difficult going. Roads were washed out, trails had standing water in them, and streams were severely flooded. By noon, over 240 had convened in the area, including local rescue squad volunteers and Boy Scout troops. The search would eventually balloon to over 1,300 volunteers, which included the National Guard, U.S. Army, and even the FBI got involved, following a couple of leads. Ultimately, the search was a failure. Park officials later acknowledged bungling the search from the start, with too many overeager volunteers, too many inexperienced eyes, too many careless feet. Nominal commanders on the scene soon lost control, overwhelmed by the number of searchers. Some volunteers had never set foot in the park before. Some didn't know how to use a compass. Everyone kept feeling that the boy would be found in the next hour, and it was probably this reason why the search organization did not keep pace with the rapid manpower buildup. Keith Nielsen, who went on to serve as park superintendent, wrote in an after-action review, "We failed to realize the need for quick organization. It was the most intensive and large-scale search that any of the park personnel had participated in." There was only one real clue. On Tuesday, June 17th, 4 days into the search, a pair of hikers stumbled across a faint set of small tracks along a water break in the Eagle Creek area, a mile below Spence Field. They were able to follow them for about 300 yards before losing the trail. Oddly, one of the prints looked to be bare, while the other alongside it was a shoe print. These prints were most definitely child-sized, and park rangers made casts of them. Search efforts were suspended on June 29th, though a handful of rangers would continue their efforts until September 11th. In the FBI files on this case, there are a few odd things that stand out. The FBI did interview one person of interest after an anonymous tip, claiming that he had a son of the same age as Dennis, and that he was in the area at that time. This lead turned into nothing. But on July 21st, 1969, quote, 5 weeks after Dennis's disappearance, and Harold Key of Carthage, Tennessee, notified the press that he had been in the park on the day the child disappeared and had heard a scream late in the afternoon, and thereafter got a glimpse of a man moving through the underbrush. Harold was not well acquainted with the park, and he was not sure where he was in relation to Spence Field, from which the child disappeared. Arrangements were made to have Harold accompany an agent to the park. In the park, Harold pointed out to an agent and a park ranger the exact location where Harold was standing when he heard the scream. This point is at such a distance from the point where the child disappeared that, in the opinion of rangers familiar with the park and considering the time element involved, it would not have been possible for the scream to have been had any connection with the disappearance of the child, end quote. From the Knox News, quote, when we got about half a mile or maybe three quarters of a mile from the car, we heard a scream. Key told News Sentinel reporter Carson Brewer, a troubled scream, an enormous sickening scream. We couldn't tell which direction it came from, but it sounded like it came from higher on the mountain to me. Minutes later, something moved in the brush. I looked across the creek and saw a man in the bushes, Key recalled. I couldn't tell much about him because he was going down the creek toward the cars. He was definitely trying to keep from being seen. I thought maybe he was a moonshiner. Key said he crossed the creek and found what looked like a crudely drawn map on a scrap of paper where the man would have been. When he came back, he noticed that the only other car parked at the roadside, an older model white Chevrolet, gone. He didn't learn about Dennis Martin until the next day. At first he kept quiet, but I got to thinking that maybe the scream had something to do with the boy's disappearance. Rangers ultimately concluded Key must have been at Sea Branch, a small stream that crosses the south leg of Cad's Cove Loop Road, west of Rowan's Creek. That would put him at least 5 miles from Spence Field, closer to 7 or as much as 9 miles away by trails. To cover that distance in the space of 2 hours or less would have taken Olympic efforts, especially for someone avoiding the trails. That's without accounting for how a kidnapper or killer could have crept up on Dennis in the open meadow on such a sunny day. Key stuck to his story through the decades, all the way to his death this year at the age of 94. But park officials then and now say there's nothing that connects the dots between whatever he saw and Dennis. On July 3rd, the few rangers still searching caught a smell. Here's the Knox News talking to Dwight McCarter, one of the searchers, 50 years later. On July 3rd, McCarter and a small crew of the remaining researchers reported a stench on the wind as they headed up the West Prong Trail below Spence Field. It was just a smell that wasn't an animal. I didn't think, he recalled. I'd smelled dead bear and deer. They smelled different. A dead crow, park officials radioed back. That area was checked already. Move on. McCarter questions that call to this day. It wasn't a crow, he said. I've smelled dead crow. This was worse. The spot would have been downwind from the water break at Eagle Creek, where hikers found child-sized tracks 4 days into the search. How certain can he be today of what he smelled? On a scale of 1 to 10, about a 5. I don't know what it was, he said, but it was worth checking. It should have been checked. In July 1985, a man approached McCarter with the story of finding a child-sized skeleton in ground disturbed by an uprooted tree in Big Hollow near Tremont years earlier. The man said he hadn't reported it because he'd been hunting ginseng illegally. A crew of 30 men searched the hollow, to no avail. In the 1990s, a man contacted park officials for details about the case. He thought he might be Dennis Martin. He wasn't. Bill Martin died in 2014, never knowing what became of his son. The family hasn't discussed the case publicly since the search ended and didn't want to talk for this story. End quote. Within the FBI's files, William Martin is painted as a caring father and persistent about the FBI's involvement in the case, though it was not in their jurisdiction if they couldn't prove that foul play was at work. Quote, "We have consistently declined to conduct any investigation for William Martin based on the many visions and insights of cranks and others that have contacted the Martin family." It's just a sad fucking story. There's an interesting attempted missing persons case featured in Jacques Vallée's Dimensions, a casebook of alien contact, and here's a Reddit post from Swift50. "I have been making my way through the published works of Dr. Jacques Vallée, a French astronomer who has been studying the UFO phenomenon since the Kenneth Arnold sighting ignited the flying saucer craze after World War II. Dr. Vallée's unique, unconventional approach to the entire subject has often greatly upset large swaths of the UFO community who prefer to think of the subject purely as a nuts and bolts phenomenon, i.e. that UFOs are advanced spacecraft piloted by extraterrestrial entities, and are thus only paranormal in the sense that we don't understand their advanced technology. Dr. Vallée's work clearly demonstrates the insufficiency of this hypothesis to explain the esoteric aspects of witnesses' experiences, and point out deep connections to profound changes in humanity that have resulted from them. Most recently, I've been reading his book, Dimensions, a Casebook of Alien Contact. In it, he publishes the testimony of a French woman about a strange and frightening experience she had that immediately made me think of 411 cases. I have emphasized the parts I found to be particularly relevant. Quote, "I was hurrying back home to prepare dinner. I was happy and content, and I was singing some popular tune. Everything was calm and still, without any breeze or wind. I was alone on the path. Suddenly I found myself within a brilliant blinding light, and I saw two huge black hands appear in front of me. Each one had five fingers, of a black color with a yellowish tinge, somewhat like copper. The fingers were roughly formed, slightly vibrating or quivering. These hands did not come from behind me, but from above, as if they had been hanging over my head, awaiting the proper time to catch me. The black hands did not immediately apply themselves to my head. I probably took two or three steps before they touched me. The hands had no visible arms. The two black hands were applied to my face with violence and squeezed my head, as a bird of prey rushes on its unfortunate, helpless victim. They pulled my head back against a very hard chest, one that seemed to be made of iron. I felt the cold through my hair and behind my neck, but no contact with clothes. The hands were squeezing my head like a formidable vice, not abruptly, but gradually. They were very cold, and their touch made me think that they were not made of flesh. The big fingers were placed on my eyes, and I could not see any more. On my nose so that I could not breathe, and also on my mouth to prevent me from crying out. When I was surrounded by the strong blinding light, I had the feeling I had been paralyzed, and when the hands touched me, I had the very distinct impression of a strong electric discharge, as if I had been shaken by a lightning bolt. My whole body was annihilated. Helpless, without reflexes. My aggressor pulled me through the bushes until we reached a small pasture, and suddenly he stopped. Why his hands had gradually slipped down my face, and I tried to call for help, but I had no voice left but a tiny shrill cry. After a while, I was able to sit among the brambles. I had a very hard time breathing. My bag was still in my hand, with the money it contained. At last, I was able to get up in spite of my weakness, and then I heard some noise to my left inside the bushes. I thought I was going to see my aggressors and recognize their faces, but I saw nothing. Only the branches moved, waving in the air. I saw and heard the brambles scratching the empty space, and the grass being pressed as if under the steps of some invisible being. I was terrified. Softly, I took to the path again, walking with difficulty. My legs were lacerated by the brambles and bleeding. I felt a strange sensation of nervous exhaustion, indefinable, as if I had been electrified by a strong current. In my mouth was a sickening, metallic, bitter taste. My muscles did not obey. Over my shoulders, I felt something like a bar, and in my back, a painful heat, as if I had been exposed to flames or to a burning ray. At times, I still felt as if I was being brushed by an invisible brush. I must have walked like that for 5 or 6 minutes. At the end of the path, there was a turn, and from there, I could see houses, and then the pain decreased a little bit. Everything had lasted a quarter of an hour or 20 minutes, and it seemed that I had lived in an unreal world. Abruptly, I heard a great noise, like a violent wind during a storm. A sudden displacement of warm air, or a violent whirlwind. I saw the trees bending as if under a sudden storm, and I was nearly thrown down. Almost simultaneously, there was a strong, blinding white light. I had the feeling something flew through the air very fast, but I saw nothing. Soon everything became calm again. I felt discomfort and nausea. I reached the house of the lockkeeper, and when I opened the door, they came toward me and asked me what had happened, because they too had seen a light from their house. The lockkeeper's wife asked me what was wrong. When I was able to speak at last, they told me all the fingers were still deeply marked in the flesh of my face, making large red bars. They applied peroxide to the scratches on my legs and an ointment and bathed my face with cold water. My hands were badly hurt. After a long lapse of time, I started again toward the town to buy a few things, without saying anything to anyone, and I came home laboriously by another path, end quote. Keep in mind that this book was published in 1988, long before Politis began his work on Missing 411. The events described took place in the central region of France on May 20th, 1950, at about 4 p.m. To me, the connections are startling. The witness describes being instantly rendered helpless and unable to cry out by an invisible being. She was left disoriented and weak, and the lacerations from being pulled through the thick foliage, as is described on many 411 cases. We're going to go to Reddit for the last case, that of Charles McCullough. This was posted in the Unresolved Mysteries Reddit by Nanan. Charles McCullough was a 19-year-old aspiring photographer from Virginia in 1970. In 1974, Charles, or Chuck, left his home state for an extended photography and hiking trip. He left behind his Volkswagen van in Virginia. With the help of a hitchhiking and a bus riding tour, in January of 1975, Charles arrived in Eugene, Oregon. He stayed with a friend in the area for a few weeks before he left to Crater Lake National Park to take winter photos. Charles planned to return to his friend's house 2 days later. Several people in the Diamond Lake area claim to have seen Charles before his disappearance. Diamond Lake is a 45-minute car ride from Crater Lake National Park. At Crater Lake, it is believed Charles planned to hike along the North Road along 5 feet, although 5 feet of snow was reported in the area for the past 2 weeks leading up to Charles' disappearance. Skiers at the time commented that the snow was so soft, even with skis, the snow went up to their waists. It is unknown if Charles changed trails. When McCullough didn't return to his friend's house on February 1st, all law enforcement agencies in Eugene were notified that he was missing. The Oregon State Police put up posters in bus stations around Eugene in hopes for Charles' safe return. Law enforcement originally believed Charles changed his plans of hiking without telling anyone. The investigation for Charles McCullough came up with no leads. According to a letter written by someone close to Charles, dated March 15, 1976, sent to then-Senator William L. Scott, the FBI was of no help. Quote, "The Federal Bureau of Investigation on two occasions has indicated that it has no authority to enter cases of missing persons. You can imagine my surprise while in Oregon searching for clues. I picked up a newspaper and read that the FBI, as well as other federal agencies, were engaged in a search for a missing person, James Hoffa." To which the senator replies, "The FBI has no authority to investigate missing persons unless there is evidence to indicate kidnapping has taken place." After months of air and ground searches, no sign of Charles McCullough were ever found. The sender of the letter also states, quote, "After returning home and reviewing the information contained in the police reports that we possess, plus maps of the area searched and intensity of these searches, without finding any signs of equipment, we concluded that Charles was not the victim of foul weather, but rather a victim of foul play," end quote. A year later, on October 13, 1976, two hikers from Texas made a wrong turn while traveling through the park. They ended up in a remote part of the Sphagnum Bog area of Crater Lake to a little desolate canyon. Upon arrival, the two hikers found an old, dirty backpack in the bog. They called the park rangers, and a day later, rangers searched the area, ultimately coming across the remains of Charles McCullough, dotted across Bybee Creek, 12 miles away from the trailhead. In the backpack, rangers find the key to a Volkswagen, later revealed to be Charles's, the one he left in Virginia. The FBI was called to complete the investigation. Charles's remains were bizarre. His jeans were reportedly unbuttoned, and his belt had come undone. In his pants, investigators found broken-off shin bones, sticking up. Investigators also found foot bones in his socks, but most of his skeletal remains seemingly vanished, except for the crown of his skull, which was found 12 feet away. Charles's camera equipment had disappeared, along with his shirt, boots, and coat. Charles's pants were found sitting on a log, and all his money was gone. It is believed Charles was experiencing hypothermia at this point. In some cases, victims take off their clothes because they too feel hot. But in reality, they're freezing to death. This reaction is called paradoxical undressing. Many theories arise to this point. How did Charles travel 12 miles from his original location? The day Charles was reported missing, there was 7 feet of snow that lined the ground, so it seemed impossible that Charles traveled so much distance without skis or snowshoes. Many deem it impossible that even a snowmobile would be able to get through 2.6 meters of powdery snow, much less a person. In 2016, Steve McCullough wrote an article on his missing brother, and in it he theorizes an interesting conclusion. Quote, "If only those broken-off shin bones could have talked to us, what do you think they'd say? I bet they say something like this. I hitched a ride with this creepy guy who stole my camera equipment and money and shot me in the head. Then, on a clear day, in the dead of winter, he hauled my body into the remotest part of Crater Lake, took my shirt and boots off, and set me up on a log and left, figuring the animals would destroy the evidence by spring. And hey, I guess it worked, because the cops ruled my death to be from natural causes. My dad doesn't buy it, though." One poster, Fox Friar, had this insight. Quote, "I think the problem with this line of reasoning is we don't know what kind of time frame we're talking about here. Charles's body was found a year later. We have no idea how much time passed between the time he hit the trail and the time he met his demise. And he may not have been dead yet by the time he was reported missing. So 12 miles in deep snow may sound unlikely if we're talking about a day or two. But if we start talking longer time frames, say a few days to a week, suddenly 12 miles isn't nearly as improbable. But he may not have even needed to walk that far. See, we don't actually know where exactly Charles entered the park either. The 12 miles figure presumes he entered at the south entrance of the park, the only visitor entrance that opens during the winter. But he may not have, after all. Sphagnum Bog, the area Charles was found, is near the northwestern edge of the park, right at the part of the park boundary that sticks out a little like the toe on a boot. This is indeed quite far from the southern visitor's entrance. However, you'll notice there's a trail that runs right along this area. It does connect with other trails that eventually head south to the visitor's entrance, but it can also be followed north, out of the park, and on another trailhead on Route 230. And from that trailhead, the Sphagnum Bog is only around 5 miles, a much shorter distance. And while you're scanning around that part of the map, you may notice the label on the road that leads north off the edge of the map, which says, to Diamond Lake, Roseburg, and I-5. Indeed, Diamond Lake is literally just past the upper edge of this map, in fact. Remember, before his disappearance, Charles was allegedly spotted in the Diamond Lake area, so he was coming from the direction when traveling to the Crater Lake. It is plausible that Charles hitchhiked from Diamond Lake, and his ride brought him down this way, dropping him off at the Boundary Springs trailhead. On Route 230, and from there, he hiked south into the park. That would make it much easier to get to where he was found. And that's going to do it for this episode of The Hum in the Silence. Thank you all so much for listening. Thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as our theme, and to Megan Lagerberg for our logo. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or emerging out of nowhere to snatch you. In gray, we trust.